This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Oh yeah, I got this too. Well, the Bible. The Bible is made up of lots of different books. You probably knew that. 66 different books. And there is a variety of authors. It was written over a huge span of time. Different personalities. Different personal histories for the authors, different kinds of education, some different languages, and a wide variety of genres. Okay, the Bible has, of course, historical narrative. It has law codes. It has prayer poetry. It has erotic love poetry. Did you know that? That's in here. It's got sayings and writings that are more like journalism. There are letters in the Bible, letters from one person to a group of people, from a few people to a group of people, apocalyptic writing, prophecies, a lot of variety. This is a beautiful thing, okay? God loves variety. He's not after sameness. Just look at the insect world. And this fact of the wide variety, this is compelling to me. It's winsome. However, there is also continuity throughout the scriptures. This is another level of beauty, really a shocking level of beauty, because there are discernible connections between these stories and sayings and poems and letters. And of course, that's because while there is a variety of authors, there is also one common author, the Holy Spirit of God, who inspired, directed, protected these books. He knit this masterpiece together, this masterpiece that tells a multi-layered story, the story of all stories. God's passion to renew this broken place and us rebels at great cost to himself. That is the big story. That's the masterpiece. But within it are lots of smaller stories or threads. There are themes, motifs, we might even call them. In a piece of music or a work of art, we often use the word motif to talk about a repeated thematic element. So it is in this masterpiece. Barry Segrin, in his wonderful little book called The Story of the Old Testament, says, "There are many threads that run through the Bible. Follow any one of them, and they lead you to Jesus Christ." I'd say go and check that out. I haven't completely tested that, but I think it's something to check out in your own study. But we are going to tug on one thread tonight, and that thread is eyesight. Eyesight in the Bible. Hello. If you're wearing some kind of knit material, I want you to look down and try and discern one thread, if you can. Maybe you have a snag, it would be easier to discern. Or you can imagine, you can remember times you've snagged something. If you snag one thread in a sweater, of course, you kind of see a bit more of where it came from, what it's connected to, where it's going. That's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to look at one thread running through the Bible, and it is eyesight. Now, I'm not attempting to pit vision against the other senses. I'm not trying to build a hierarchy of senses tonight and say vision versus hearing, That's not my goal. Instead, I've just focused on eyesight because in my own study, I've become aware of this as a theme. Back in the summer, I was preparing to lead a Bible study on the book of Ruth, and I thought, I'm just going to read through the Bible from Genesis right up to Ruth to get some context, to get ready to teach. And when I got to about the Exodus story, I kept seeing, and for the first time in my Bible reading, I kept seeing repetitions of the word saw or see or sight or behold or watch or look. And I couldn't believe how much was in the Exodus story. And so I just kept watching as I've continued to read and tried to note what's going on with this thread. So, two major players in this thread. Big surprise. God. God's sight. And human sight. Of course, other creatures, other beings have sight in the scriptures, but these are the major players. And I can't be exhaustive on this topic tonight. I just hope to offer you one way that the Bible writers use sight, and it's this. I think over and over and over again, it's connected to judgment. Now hold on, stay with me. I've used a difficult word, and in our vernacular, it's pretty much negative, this word. We use it more or less only in a negative way, as in, don't be judgy, or how dare you judge me, or I'm not trying to judge, but, and if you're familiar with the Myers-Briggs, if you get the J instead of the P, you feel a little bit bad about that. So while this is, of course, included in what I'm saying, the definition of judgment is much broader than just a negative assessment. The definition is more like the ability to make considered decisions or come to sensible conclusions. And I'm convinced that the scriptures uses this word in that broader way. Let me give you some examples. From 1 Chronicles 16, this is talking about God's sight. He is the Lord our God. His judgments are in all the earth. Also in 1 Chronicles, remember the wonders he has done, the judgments he pronounced. Psalm 48, Mount Zion rejoices because of your judgments. So I'm using it broader than just this negative assessment. Imagine that I say, Shauna, you don't have to imagine, I'm just going to say, Shauna, you look beautiful tonight. It's unlikely that Shauna's going to go home later and be like, man, Anna is so judgmental. And yet I have made a judgment. I've come to a conclusion. Or think about if you see a movie that you really enjoy, you leave the movie theater, you might be talking to your friend and say, wow, that movie was well done. It was really interesting. You've made a judgment on the movie, though it's a positive judgment. If you ever get on Rotten Tomatoes website, does anybody ever check Rotten Tomatoes? You go there looking for judgments. You're looking for the red splat. Or what's the other one? Is it like a green?
It's like a green splat.
There you go. So judgments can be both positive and negative. Or even consider a judge in a courtroom. Judges are not always and only saying bad, guilty, sentenced, punished. Judges also say innocent, free. So I want you to hold on to that as we continue through the lecture and talk about judgment. You can see probably at this point that I'm using the word more like discernment or like wise dividing. And eyes or sight in the Bible, they're over and over again connected to this wise dividing. So this is my hope for tonight. We are going to build a timeline. I said in the description of this lecture, we're going to do a broad stroke look at God's sight and human sight. That's exactly what we're going to do. But I will warn you that it's going to get very full, and those in the back will probably not be able to see it. But I'm going to say everything that comes up. So if you're really squinting, don't worry. I will say what's there. So let's jump in. Let's look at the very first reference of sight. Reference to sight in the Bible. You can probably guess what it is. God saw that it was good. Seven times it says that. Ben, you mentioned this last week in your lecture. Anytime the Bible says something seven times, you know it's important. There's a fullness to it, a completion, a perfection to it. Now, there's a lot going on here. A lot of ink has been spilt on Genesis 1. But I want to begin really simply by just saying God is revealed to us here as a seeing God. The invisible one possesses vision. That's a compelling thing to even meditate on for a while. He sees. And he rightly sees, we might say. He rightly sees that what he's made is good. Often these repeated sentences in Genesis get misquoted. People say that God said that it was good. But the text actually says God saw that it was good. Seven times, that's what's being said. This is a judgment of sorts. God is revealed to us here not only possessing sight, but sight that rightly identifies good as good. He has wise sight. He's not fooled. He's not confused. And I think we're meant to read this as not just God's opinion, God thinks it's pretty good, but as the truth revealed. He sees rightly, he sees wisely. Let's contrast this with the next being who sees. It's Eve. However, it's the serpent who first mentions sight. The serpent says, "Your eyes will be opened." Something having to do with vision is part of the temptation in the garden. And the serpent links this kind of promised change in her vision to knowing good and evil. The serpent says, "Your eyes will be opened, you'll be like God if you eat this fruit, knowing good and evil." I find that especially interesting because chapter 1 has just shown God to be the seer of good. And yet the serpent says to Eve, "Your eyes will be opened and you'll know good and evil." So what does Eve do? Well, to make her decision, she uses her eye. It says, when the woman saw that the fruit was good, when she saw it was pleasing to the eye, exactly. So her sight leads her. Obviously, she wants the serpent's promised change in vision, so she follows what pleases her eye. And do her eyes judge well? Do her eyes discern well? That is the question. So when God saw the goodness of creation, we could say he saw clearly, rightly, judged rightly. But when Eve sees the fruit, her eyes discern poorly, to put it mildly. So I'm convinced that this contrast runs right on through the Bible, right through this thread of sight, all the way through. So I want to check it out. We're going to first just talk about God's sight. We're going to just basically touch on various points throughout the scriptures. We'll stay on the top realm for a little bit, and then we'll talk about human sight. So the first handful of stories after the fall wonderfully illustrate first just the scope of God's sight. Genesis 6, we see the Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on earth. See how huge that is? He saw the wickedness of the human race on earth. It's a really enormous scope. And then a few verses later, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. And this happens a lot in the Bible, this kind of zooming out and then zooming in. So God looks at the whole earth and makes a judgment, corrupt, and then zooms into one particular man. And he's named as righteous. It says the earth / Noah. And then again, a few chapters later, we've got this huge zooming out. The whole world had one language, we read about the Tower of Babel. The whole world said to one another, "Let's build a city, let's build a tower." So the Lord comes to see the city and the tower. So again, it's this huge scope, all the whole world all together. Then a few chapters later, zooms in on one woman, Hagar. She's in the wilderness, and amazingly, she actually gives a name to God. If you're familiar with the story, she says, "You are the God who sees me." So it's this kind of, the scope of God's vision is being described in these stories. It's huge, singles in on one person. And of course there are other stories mixed in here. I'm not claiming to name every story in the scriptures, but these are stories where God's sight in particular is named. And I think it shows us the big picture, shows us individuals. And it shows us God's judgments through his sight. He sees the corrupt world. He sees one righteous man. He sees a bad plan in a city. And he sees one mistreated woman. So here's the first kind of summarizing word I want you to hold on to with regard to God's sight. It is unlimited. However, these stories don't just speak about scope, as I've already said, but his true perception. His sight is clear. He sees corruption. He sees a victim, right? He sees evil. He sees righteousness. And he knows which is which. We could say his vision is 20/20 in these stories. God's sight is true, reflecting reality. Nothing obscures his vision. He has no blind spots. His piercing vision divides rightly between good and evil, righteousness and wickedness. Let's carry on, holding that first word with us, unlimited. The next major story that mentions his sight is the Exodus. I already said this was kind of where this lecture began for me. The Lord saw Israel suffering in Egypt. He saw that it was wrong for them to be in slavery. He sees nations quite clearly in this story and their activity. He sees clearly that they need rescue. We're going to keep moving for me to touch all these. The next one is shortly after the rescue from Egypt, God gives the law to his people. And he gives the law in terms of what is good in the Lord's sight and what is evil in God's sight. Do this. Do what is good in God's sight. Do what pleases the Lord's sight. Don't do this. What is evil? What is detestable in the Lord's sight? The language of the law is wrapped in language of God's seeing, God's sight. All right, next. If you know your Bible a little bit, you might be anticipating what's coming next. After the giving of the law, various leaders are brought into, or God appoints various leaders to lead, to shepherd, to judge the people of Israel. And there is so much said back and forth about them, various leaders doing well, doing good in the sight of the Lord, doing evil in the sight of the Lord. It's a major motif. Ironically, it's especially in the case of the judges who are meant to judge wisely and right. Some do well, some do evil in the sight of the Lord. Then comes a king in the story. A prophet is sent to anoint Israel's second king. And in 1 Samuel, we get kind of a fuller revelation. The Lord actually says about himself, because Samuel's thinking, all right, we need a king. He needs to be good looking. He needs to be tall. He needs to be popular, obviously. And then the prophet, speaking for the Lord, says, no, the Lord doesn't look at what we look at. The Lord looks at the heart. This is like a fuller revelation of God's piercing, dividing vision. So it's not only unlimited in scope. Not only does God obviously see the outer appearances, but we see here he sees straight into the heart. So this is the second word I want us to hold on to as we keep traveling through the timeline. God's sight is trustworthy. God's sight is unlimited. But he also sees right down into the heart. Hold both of those with you as we keep moving in the story. The next thing I want to highlight is about the temple. So the temple is built to be this place of God's presence, a place of worship, of prayer, of sacrifice and absolution. And I had never seen this before, but in 1 Kings 9, God says this, "I have consecrated this temple which you have built. My eyes and my heart will always be there." It's in 1 Kings 9. "My eyes and my heart will always be there." You'll have to come to Sarah's lecture in a few weeks to learn about the heart part.
Taking note of this.
She's doing a lecture on the heart a few weeks from now. So the temple is this place of judgment, we could say, a place where people go to deal with sin, to confess, to receive forgiveness, and this is the place where God's eyes will always be, according to this verse. So remember, broad strokes. We're now skipping ahead to Job. We've talked about Job a few times in the last week or so here at LaBrie. Job is like a long conversation between Job and his friends, and then towards the end, God has clearly been listening, but then God joins the conversation and essentially delivers a barrage of questions, about 75 questions to my reckoning, towards the end of Job. And though the phrase, "have you seen," only comes up a few times, I think it's fair to summarize God's questions as, "have you seen what I've seen?" God says, "have you seen where hail is stored?" One of the verses actually says, "have you seen where darkness dwells? Have you seen these deep sea creatures? Have you seen these animals on the high cliffs in the mountains?" I mean, obviously Job could only answer no to all of these questions. And so it's this refrain of, "have you seen?" And somehow this speaks to God's role in the story as the arbiter, the judge of good and evil. As this conversation has been wrestling with, how could God do this? Would God do this? What about this? Who's responsible? What about, you know, so many questions. And somehow God's saying, "have you seen what I've seen?" is his response. Next, the Psalms. The Psalms are absolutely full of affirmations of God's everywhere sight, but also that his eyes are evaluating, his eyes are discerning, his eyes are judging. This is just a few references. "The Lord observes everyone on earth. His eyes examine them. His eyes watch the nations. Does he who formed the eye not see?" Those are from Psalm 11, Psalm 66, Psalm 94. And here are a couple more that were just too good not to share. Psalm 33. "From heaven the Lord looks down and sees all mankind. From his dwelling place he watches all who live on earth. He who forms the heart of all, who considers everything they do." That's God's wise vision. Psalm 53, "God looks down from heaven on all mankind to see if there are any who understand, any who seek God." I love that, especially as we consider positive judgments. We can falsely think God's just looking out so he knows who to zap, who to be mad at. But this verse clearly says he's looking to see, is there anyone looking back at me? Is there anybody seeking God? It's positive judgments in the Psalms. Moving on to the prophets. There's a refrain throughout the prophets of God hiding his face from Israel. This might sound like it wouldn't go here. I don't think what's being said is that God doesn't see, but rather what's being suggested is more of an exhaustion on God's part, an anger on God's part of seeing so much rebellion, so much wickedness. And interestingly, their response to this hiding his face or turning his face away is, "look, God, open your eyes, Lord, and see." This asking God to look is a request for judgment, in a way. It's saying, "God, come, look at this, make things right, open your eyes. Throughout the Bible, we see that when the inverse of these two summarizing words I've given you are at work, things really go bad. When people either think God is blind, God doesn't see, or God's sight is somehow skewed, is not trustworthy, is wrongly discerning things. I'm going to read you a bit from Psalm 94 that addresses this exactly. The Lord is a God who avenges. O God who avenges, shine forth. Rise up, judge of the earth. Pay back to the proud what they deserve. How long, Lord, will the wicked, how long will the wicked be jubilant? They pour out arrogant words. All the evildoers are full of boasting. They crush your people, Lord. They oppress your inheritance. They slay the widow and the foreigner. They murder the fatherless. They say, the Lord does not see. The God of Jacob takes no notice. Another brief one in Psalm 10. In his pride, the wicked man does not seek the Lord. In all his thoughts, there's no room for God. His ways are always prosperous. Your laws are rejected by him. He says to himself, nothing will ever shake me. He swears no one will ever do me harm. His mouth is full of lies. Trouble and evil are under his tongue. His eyes watch in secret for his victims. That's what he does with his eyes. Like a lion in cover, he lies in wait. His victims are crushed. They collapse. They fall under his strength. Listen to this. He says to himself, God will never notice. He covers his face and never sees. So when humans imagine the inverse of either of these, that God can't see something or that somehow God's sight is skewed, things go really awry. I love how in our church, on almost a weekly basis, we pray this prayer to God, from you no secrets are hid. It's a beautiful refrain. And the Old Testament authors are convinced of this, that in reality, God sees everything. His sight is unlimited. And his sight is clear-eyed. It's not skewed. It's trustworthy. I've mentioned a bit about the Exodus story and how that's kind of where this whole study began for me. If you go back and read it, you'll notice lots of references to the overseers, the people who are in charge of the Israelites, who are making their work more and more difficult. The overseers are the ones really kind of oppressing the people of Egypt, the people of Israel in Egypt. And I love that something that you take away from the story is, no, actually, God is the overseer. He's the overseer of all the overseers. So they may have thought they were going to destroy Israel, but in fact, the overseer comes and rescues them. So his sight is clear. His sight is trustworthy. The Old Testament authors want us to know this, and I'm happy to tell you, it continues right on into the New Testament. The coming of Jesus is, of course, a fuller revelation of God's close-up vision, we might say. There's still some zooming in and some zooming out. You're probably aware of how many passages say Jesus saw the crowds and he had compassion on them, or he looked on Jerusalem, he wept over Jerusalem, he sees the big picture. But then also, he sees one woman, the woman who had been bleeding for 12 years. It says he turned and looked at her. He looked straight at his disciples. Go and look in the Gospels and notice how much it says he looked at Andrew, he looked at Simon, he looked at Philip, he looked at Nathaniel. In all four Gospels, Jesus looks at individuals. He looks at individuals and he discerns. He judges, we could say. He pronounces forgiveness when he looks at people. He warns people when he looks straight at them. There's an instance when he looks at two leaders. I don't know if they're called chief priests in the story, but Jewish leaders. It says he looked right at them and said, "The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. So his sight, his piercing sight, rightly divides, pronounces forgiveness, warnings, healings from what he sees. And Jesus is obviously also aware of the Father's unlimited sight. Matthew 6, we see this beautiful phrase three times. Jesus says, "Your Father who sees." It's the passage about God seeing the things you do in secret. There's no secret. Your Father who sees what nobody else sees. And I think it's helpful to note that even after Jesus' ascension, this phrase that's been used all throughout the Bible, in the sight of God, in the sight of the Lord, something gets added to that in the New Testament. We see several times it says, in the sight of Christ and in the sight of God. So we have even more eyes on us. No, I'm just kidding. That's a weird way of saying it, obviously. But there's continuity in the story between God's unlimited sight and his clear-eyed vision and the life and ministry of Jesus. It does seem to me in the New Testament, though, there's something added to this idea where the sight of God starts being talked more and more about, or talked about in terms of the final judgment. That there will be a kind of presenting before God's sight on judgment day. We will be presented, Paul says, as blameless in his sight or as holy in his sight. When any imagined secrecy will be laid bare. I just got two more for God's sake. In Hebrews, this is kind of the highlight of God's sight. I'm going to read it from my Bible here. This is where I've got the idea, too, of thinking of it as dividing sight, a division. Can you hear the word vision in there? For the word of God is alive and active, sharper than any double-edged sword. It penetrates even to dividing soul and spirit, joints and marrow. It judges the thoughts and attitudes of the heart. Hear this. Nothing in all creation is hidden from God's sight. Everything is uncovered and laid bare before the eyes of him to whom we must give account. And then finally, in Revelation, John has a vision of Jesus' return, and he says his eyes were like blazing fire. Of course, if you have some sense of the scriptures, fire is the symbol of judgment. That what can be burned will be burned, and what remains has been purified. This is a recurring image throughout the scriptures. This is what Jesus' eyes will be like when he returns. All right, we've looked at God's sight, broad stroke, and we've summarized it with these two words, unlimited, trustworthy. And now we're going to move on to human sight. We've already talked about Eve, and we established that human sight is easily obscured. And this question reverberates on down through human history and into our day and into our hearts. Do we do well? I was thinking of Jonah. Do we do well to let our eyes be the judge? Do we want to trust our sight that much? That's an important question to keep with us as we look at this part of the timeline. Yes, they're a gift. I'm not trying to get away from that. They're amazing physiologically, what our eyes can do. But the scriptures want us to see, I think, that they are so impaired when used as tools for discernment. So let's look on at the timeline. The next one I've chosen to talk about is Hagar again. Did you know she runs away twice? So this is actually a different story. Hagar's run away. She's in the wilderness yet again. She has her son with her. It's a beautiful story, actually, because it says God heard the boy crying and opened her eyes to see that there was a well of water nearby. They're in the desert, presumably about to die of thirst, or really in need of water. And it says God opened her eyes to see this source of water. I just love that contrast between Eve and Hagar. Will we be the ones to decide to try and open our own eyes? Or will we let God open our eyes to the spring of living water? I'm bringing some New Testament into the Old Testament there, but God does the opening of her eyes. Now we're into Judges. Probably know this phrase. Here are these figures, these leaders who are meant to be the arbiters, the ones teaching the people of Israel good and evil. But it was a dark time in Israel's history. Instead of letting the rightful judges discern, it says everyone did, you probably know it, yeah, what was right in their own eyes or as they saw fit, what some translations say. So these judges had been appointed. These judges were able to help people discern good from evil, but the people of Israel were deciding, I think I can see this pretty clearly. I think my eyes are good enough for discerning what's good and what's evil. So like Eve, and so like us, if we're honest. Letting obscured vision lead us in our judgments, in our decisions, in the way we live. So the Bible continues to show us human sight is obscured by a few things. These are going to be your summarizing words to hold on to. Human sight. Big surprise. Limited. And I'm not really talking about sin at this point, just by virtue of being creatures. We are finite. There are even passages throughout the Bible talking about grief obscuring our sight. This is just a result of being a human in a broken world. Our physical sight and our spiritual sight, they're fragile. They're limited. Have you ever had your eyes dilated? I just had this done a few weeks ago, and foolishly I did it at like 1:45 in the afternoon. So I had the whole day to deal with it. And I came home thinking, oh, I could get some reading done. Nope. I was in the middle of a sewing project. I couldn't get the thread through the needle at all. I thought, well, I'll do some work on the computer. Nope. The only thing I could do was wash dishes. That's a terrible position to be in. Our eyes are just fragile. And when just a little something goes wrong, man, you feel the effects of it. So whereas God's sight is shown to be unlimited, ours is seriously limited. We are not God. We don't possess his sight. However, this isn't the whole story. It's not just that poor sight happens to us by virtue of being human. We actively choose to use our sight inappropriately. We actively rebel with our sight. That is clear throughout the scriptures. Eve was seemingly not okay with her limited vision. She did what was right in her own eyes, we might say. And so did Israel, and so do we. Into Proverbs. Proverbs 3. Don't be wise in your own eyes. The direct command there. This comes right after trust in the Lord with all your heart. So trusting in the one whose sight is unlimited, whose sight is clear, trustworthy, and don't be wise in your own eyes. Don't imagine you could be the arbiter of good and evil, of wisdom, with your own eyes. And Proverbs 6:16, are you familiar with the passage? These are the six things God hates, the seven things that are detestable. Do you know what the very first thing is? Haughty eyes. That's kind of not what I would expect to be the very first thing listed in these are the things that God hates. Haughty eyes. Do you see the judging in that? An arrogance that uses the eye to say, yeah, I'm better than that. I can look down on that. So I'd say we need some healthy suspicion towards our eyes. Some healthy suspicion towards our eyes' ability to judge situations, to judge people, to judge God. And I haven't even mentioned yet how much the Bible does not mince words about our obscured vision and just calls us straight up blind. Many times. This is Ezekiel 12. I don't have it in my notes. I got to read it on here. Foolish and senseless people who have eyes but do not see. There are many passages like this that speak of our blindness. And how many times was Israel warned that they would become like that which they worshipped? Which is actually a beautiful promise too, because as you worship God, we become more like Him. We don't become God, but we're transformed. Our desires, our longings, all of that is changed into more like God. But the same applies to worshiping other things, anything other than God. If you are worshiping something blind, deaf, mute, impotent, I don't mean sexually, but just without power, that is what you will become like. This psalm specifically says, idols have eyes but cannot see. Those who make them will be like them, and so will all who trust in them. And that is clearly what happens as a judgment, a negative judgment on rebellion. Israel becomes blind. Isaiah 6 is a passage that speaks particularly to this. Jesus is quoted, or Jesus quotes Isaiah 6. That's recorded in all three synoptic gospels. All three of them have Jesus quoting this prophetic passage. And I even think it's alluded to in John 9. This is the passage where Isaiah sees the Lord. He's high and lifted up, his throne, his robe fills the temple. And then Isaiah is overwhelmed because he senses his own uncleanness. The angel comes, brings something from the fire to touch his lips. And this is what it says. Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? And I said, here am I, send me. That's always kind of like a verse they use to like inspire people to go be a missionary or something. But here's what the mission is. Go and tell this people. Be ever hearing, but never understanding. Be ever seeing, but never perceiving. Make the heart of the people calloused. Make their ears dull and close their eyes. Otherwise, they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and turn and be healed. This is a rough message. Then I said, for how long, Lord? And he answered, until the cities lie ruined and without inhabitant, until the houses are left deserted and the fields ruined and ravaged, until the Lord has sent everyone far away and the land is utterly forsaken. And though a tenth remain in the land, it will again be laid waste. But as the terebinth and oak leave stumps when they are cut down, so the holy seed will be the stump in the land. I'm so glad there's some hope at the end of that passage. That's good. But the message being, we can be blinded as a judgment, blinded by persistent rebellion. So our sight is limited, not so trustworthy, rebellious. We're just straight up blind. But at this point in the story, the idea of blindness kind of readies us for the great relief in some messianic prophecies. Right? There's been a diagnosis, blind. But there's also a prescription. There is one who will come, one who will proclaim recovery of sight for the blind. That's what it says in Isaiah 61. That's the passage Jesus reads at the beginning of his ministry. There are so many messianic prophecies about blindness being healed. It's obvious that we need this healing from blindness. And Jesus comes and does just this. There's a point where John the Baptist sends some of his disciples. I think John the Baptist is already in prison. He sends some disciples to Jesus to essentially ask, you know, he knows these prophecies. Jesus, are you the one? And Jesus' response is, tell him this, the blind receive sight. And then he goes on, says other things, but that's the first thing he says. He wants to know if I'm the one. The blind receive sight. This is evidence of the kingdom come. This is the good news. This is the repeated story throughout the New Testament, throughout every gospel. Jesus offers sight for the blind. And of course, he physically, literally heals many blind people, but also a spiritual opening of the eyes, opening of the spiritual eyes to the truth of who God is, the truth of who we are, the truth of redemption in Jesus. All right, we are nearly at the end. That's the really good news. That's why it's in orange. Jesus heals blindness. Jesus' teaching includes a realism about our continued struggle with our eyes, our continued limitations, our continued rebellion, continued blindness. Specks and planks, which is a teaching having to do with judging, again. It's like, you know, are you really going to look at someone and say, you've got a little bit of dust in your eye? And the image is when you have like this oak tree sticking out of your eye. Like, don't do that. That's not what you should be doing. First deal with this. Then you might be able to help your brother with a bit of sawdust in his eye. So Jesus is realistic about our ongoing struggles with sight. You're familiar with this one, I'm sure. If your eye causes you to sin. I wonder why this passage isn't when your eye causes you to sin, but that's not what it is. It says, if your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out. Jesus' prescription there is radical. All right, next, just going to touch briefly on Saul's conversion. When Saul meets this Jesus on the road to Damascus, what happens to him? He is struck blind. Exactly. He's blinded, and then he has to humble himself, go to someone who already knows this Jesus to receive restored sight. But then incredible grace in this story. It's overwhelming to me. The Lord says to Saul on the road, after he's blinded him, I'm sending you to the Gentiles to open their eyes. That's what the story says. Blind humans with restored sight can be included in opening others' eyes. How beautiful is that? Now, he has to live it before he can teach it. So he has to actually journey through the blindness into restored sight before he can offer that to others. And Dave shared with me this article that's really interesting that tries to make a case for, you know, Paul's thorn in the flesh, that maybe it was an ongoing eye problem from his conversion. Because of some passages that say, you know, Paul says at one point, they would have given me their own eyes if they could have, or something, and a few other things. It's not conclusive, but it's an interesting idea that the one who was blinded by his encounter with Jesus continues to be impaired by it, and yet offers sight and recovery of sight to the Gentiles. All right, very last thing I want to look at. I've already said this about Saul. Even blind humans who have received restored sight can be invited to participate in redemption with our eyes. And so it is in Revelation. I want to read you an excerpt from this great commentary on Revelation by Daryl Johnson. It's called Discipleship on the Edge. He has a lot to say about sight in the book of Revelation. I'm going to read you a couple of paragraphs. Talking about Revelation 4 in particular. What does John see in that other dimension so close at hand? Look, he says, behold. It's unfortunate that some translations miss this and render John's words as there before me. In both verses, John's word is a verb, the verb to see. And in both cases, the verb is in the imperative mood. Behold, or lo, meaning look. John is not making a statement. He's giving an exhortation, a command. Look. Look is the most frequent command in the entire book of Revelation. Look, says John, the door into heaven is opened. And look, a throne. That is what John wants his fellow disciples to see, a throne. There is a supreme headquarters. There is a control center of the universe. There is a seat of authority and power. Through our ordinary set of glasses, we could conclude otherwise. Look, a throne. Not way out there, not way up there, close at hand, so very close, right here. We cannot see it with the unaided eye. We may not be able to see it with the set of glasses given to us, but put on Revelation 4 glasses. Look, do you see the throne? It's the most dominant image in Revelation. John refers to it 47 times and uses other related terms 77 times. Look, says John, a throne. Look, a throne was standing open in heaven and one sitting on the throne. Good news, the throne of the universe is occupied. So in this command to look, our eyes are included in the redemption story. Yes, our eyes are limited. Yes, our eyes are rebellious. But they are not irredeemable. Jesus has come for just this kind of people, limited, rebellious, blind. But we can join in on his redemption work, receive sight from him, look to the throne, and trust the overseer. That's all I have to say. Well, as per the Libri way, we can now discuss this a bit more, if you like. Our pastor recently said he's doing a sermon series on money, and he didn't want to do a Q&A after the sermon, but agreed to do a Q&R, question and response, as opposed to question and answer. So I thought I might grab a hold of that for tonight and say we have some Q&R time. If you have questions about this, things you'd like to talk more about, things you've seen in the scriptures that you want to add to this, now's the time, and I would love to hear it. Yes?
Maybe we can start with CNR, comment and response.
There we go.
As you were talking about vision and seeing the Bible, it's kind of struck me the complementary nature of seeing and hearing.
Yeah.
In scripture. So seeing is, as you say, discerning and understanding, and then hearing is more about not just kind of hearing and listening and paying attention, but also obeying. So
yeah, obedience.
Seeing is kind of understanding, and hearing is taking action.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. As I was just kind of searching this out, I was so drawn into the connection between seeing, hearing, and the heart. The heart is so often included in a short passage that talks about sight and hearing. That's good, yeah.
So you talked a little about... why are you laughing at me? Are sighting impaired? That
yeah.
Also restored.
Yeah.
You also mentioned the idea of trust somewhere. So
yeah.
I'm wondering, how do you see the ideas of trusting and seeing coming together for people who have received some sort of healing spiritually, vision-wise from Jesus? So.
Yeah.
Sometimes it feels like trusting comes with not being able to see. If that makes sense as a question.
Yeah, that's a good point. I would say it at least starts with maybe being or confessing our lack of sight in order to move towards trust. Is that kind of what you're suggesting, that we need to name our blindness in order to move closer to trust?
I didn't have a particular thing in mind. It just felt like sometimes, you know, in our participation, it seems like we're asked to, try to see better. And then other times, we're asked to not rely on ours. I mean, in both cases, the source is God. Right?
Yeah.
God is the one providing this. So I was just wondering the dynamic between trusting and seeing for ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, our sight is always derivative, no matter how small. But I guess what I wanted to say is that it also gets included. It makes me think of the story where Jesus kind of heals the man's sight, but it's not like totally healed, which is strange. I mean, it's a bit of an odd story. He spits on the ground, makes some mud, puts it on the guy's face, and then he says, you know, I see people, but they look like trees walking. And then Jesus touches him again, and it says something like, and everything was clear. It's a really strong language. So I guess I would see us as somewhere in that journey, that as we're moving, I mean, it's not like trust is something that's like a place where you just arrive and now your sight is clear, but more like, oh yeah, things are still blurry to me at times. I still need to continue to be touched by Jesus in order to see more clearly, to grow in trust. Yeah. I think some other people have some comments along those lines, though. Yeah? Marty?
Well, you said, this passage came to mind, which I can't remember where it is, but where Jesus said, blessed are those who believe without seeing.
Yeah. Yep.
Where is that? You probably came across.
Yes.
Edward Thomas.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
So close to that is I think we want to see, but we are not meant to be able to see,
mm-hmm.
like the future,
mm-hmm.
so we don't need to trust.
Mm-hmm.
So not being able to see is the way God wants us to be, that we can trust him instead of knowing the future all down the line.
There you go. There's something about, I didn't use these words in this lecture, but there is something about like appropriate vision for a human and inappropriate vision for a human, like vision that is God's domain. And at least in part, trusting is saying, I'm trusting your appropriate vision, because I couldn't even attempt to have that. Yes, Lenny.
And we also, our preconceptions affect what we see.
Yeah.
What we see isn't always what's there.
So true.
If we think we're going to see something, we'll often see it and not see other things. So it's the trust part is, we need help to clear all those other things that get in the way, where we have a focus that's kind of skewed or aren't seeing things correctly or in the right proportions or whatever, so that we can really see what's there.
And I think that's at least part of what's happening in the passage about we live by faith and not by sight. It's about, you know, our bodies. The whole passage is about like these tents that are falling apart, and we don't want to live by what we can only see. But trusting, I mean, Hebrews is like being certain of what we do not see. I didn't even have time to go into like seeing the unseen, but that's certainly there as well. Yes.
Well, I was wondering, like, maybe we get a sense of, if you mentioned these verses, of God opening our eyes, mm-hmm. Jesus opening the eyes of the blind, and maybe we get a sense of, oh, that means we're going to have unlimited vision.
Right, yeah. No.
And then it's opening your eyes to still limited vision.
Yeah.
To see in part.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like some things that are meant to be kept from us, like the future.
Yeah.
Or just parts of the future we're told about in a very limited way that makes room for plenty of trust. But, we've talked a lot this lecture, and I've always, you know, heard, God opened the eyes of my heart, or help me see like you see, which I think is good, but I never thought of, oh, there's a way that God sees that I'm not supposed to see, like I'm not supposed to have unlimited sight.
Yeah.
There's certain things that aren't good for me to see, and so, I don't, hearing you talk about this has helped me think, oh, there's just an appropriate amount of sight I'm supposed to ask for, not like a...
Yeah, our sight never turns into God's sight.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem, yeah. Ben.
It's also, it's more than just, there's different aspects of even God's side. It's like the all-encompassing nature of it, every detail, you know. And that's obviously something that we're limited. We shouldn't expect to see that, including into the future. But then there's the seeing rightly, judging rightly, which seems to be has more to do with wisdom than knowledge.
Yeah.
More to do with, well, do you actually do what is right with what you see?
Yeah.
And that to me is something that we should expect to be able to grow in forever, maybe. You know, it's not a quantitative vision like, yes, I see the distant galaxies and I see the microorganisms or something like this, but it's about obedience and holiness and sanctification and wisdom.
Yeah. It's like responding to what we do actually see.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. In Deuteronomy, it's said so many times, like Israel is reminded, all of the things that God did for you to rescue you from Egypt, he did before your very eyes. That phrase is said over and over and over again. It's kind of like, you know, it's not just about kind of seeing or not seeing, but also like what you do with when God does open your eyes to certain things, when he does show you things.
When you said about Eve's servant promises more sight, mm-hmm. that to me was screaming understanding. So she understood what was there.
Mm-hmm.
But when he said that you will see more, it was really giving her more understanding of the world, the ugliness too that's out there.
Yeah.
Because she could only see good until he opened her eyes in that way. But I see it as an understanding. And so when you were talking about the mud, too, and how it can only see as our journey goes through, I feel like when you become a believer, you're such a baby of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And that journey takes you, and your eyes continue to be opened more and more and more. And the understanding grows and grows and grows. So the sight, to me, is a lot more understanding, because with the understanding comes more faith.
Understanding is another, I think, great word to kind of like rightly discerning.
Yeah,
that's kind of what understanding is. That's good. Was there somebody back here that I missed? Marie.
I'm sure you came across this. I wonder your thoughts about the way in the New Testament sometimes eyes are describing your desires, the lust of the flesh.
Yeah.
Or the lust of the eyes.
Yeah, 1 John 3.
And
yeah.
That what you set your eyes on, what you're desiring.
Yeah.
Did you come across, I'd love any reflections you have on that, if you came across.
I don't. I mean, we talked to you guys about that briefly, and I tried to keep my eyes open to connections between desire.
That's where the heart comes in, because that's the seat of desire.
There you go. There you go. So many times sight is connection. Do you have a comment about that?
That kind of encompasses that our blessed are the pure in heart. They will see
God. They will see God. There you go. That's good.
I think it has everything to do with what you said, which is that rightly judging.
Yeah.
I mean, desire can come out of a whole sense of the value of something that I desire.
Yeah.
Of course, your desire can be completely whacked.
Yep.
Desiring all the wrong things. But I think it connects very much with what you said.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's
good. Yes.
We're often told when sometimes we're going through troubles to fix our eyes on Jesus.
Yes.
So given the fact that we have also imaginations and warped sight, how do you fix your eyes on Jesus to like cut through the nonsense and get and see something new?
Yeah.
Something real.
Yeah. That's so great.
I mean, you know, how do you do it? I find that just a platitude. Fix your eyes on Jesus. Help it solve the problem. Well,
yeah.
Thanks.
Thanks. I can't see him.
Presumes I see him clearly enough.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I have thought about that a bit, and I've meditated on that a bit. Like, what does that mean? How do we do that for those of us who have never seen him with our physical eyes? And I have started praying the things that the blind people that Jesus heals in the gospel stories, if you just read those little conversations back and forth, they are powerful conversations. First of all, every single one of them, in every single one of them, Jesus asks them a question, which isn't true in every healing, but all the healings of blindness, Jesus asks a question. In a lot of the repeated ones, it's, what do you want me to do for you? And often they say, Lord, I want to see. So I just started praying the exact words of the various people who were healed of blindness as a sort of recognition of my own blindness. And obviously, Jesus responds well to these words. So I've tried to kind of take their words on my own lips and say, I want to see. Have mercy on me. Have mercy on me, Son of David. I want my sight. Yes.
I think it's probably a lot of other things, too. But in one sense, it means bring him into the picture. Don't limit your vision to just what's going on around you.
Yeah.
You can be so just distracted because we've got too small a picture of things.
Yeah.
And to fix our eyes on him takes our eyes out on the one who sees all things, who sees me and loves me.
Yeah.
And just bring him into the picture.
Yeah.
How he sees things, how he sees me.
Yeah.
And try to understand some of what we can learn because of how he sees.
Yeah. And that's a lot of what he says, honestly, in this commentary on Revelation, too. It's like having a baptized imagination.
Exactly.
You know, like growing.
Imagination is a huge part of it.
Exactly. I so wanted to go down that road, but I had to resist it for this lecture. Another lecture on imagination. To have, our inner sight, the eyes of our hearts more and more fixed on Jesus. Yeah, Mary Frances.
Yeah, first of all, thank you, Anna. That sounds really interesting. Mm. But to that, I was quite, I mean, you just brought this up, but I was quite taken by the passage you read from Daryl Johnson in Revelation and the number of times that John says, look, and that what he points us to is the throne and the fact that the throne is not empty.
Yes.
The throne is occupied. And so I think even in response to Tom's question, like, fix your eyes on Jesus, I think there's a piece of it.
Yeah.
Which is an intent. It's. I like what you said about engaging our imagination, but it's this intentional seeing that Christ is on the throne.
Yeah.
And for Christ to be on the throne, that means A, the throne hasn't been abdicated, and B, we're not on it.
Yeah.
And so I think that is such a helpful. I mean, Revelation is also pointing us to, like, what this will look like in in redemption, and we are not there yet.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's not where we are. But that truth, that Christ is also on the throne today, right now, even though we're not kind of fully in that place yet. And so I was thinking that anyway before Tom asked the question, but I think it's connected. I think that it's, there's a sense of, like, okay, fix your eyes on Jesus, what are we supposed to look at?
What are we, yeah.
Really, you know, if you're going down to it, that there is a sense of, hey, we are looking at the one who's on the throne.
Yeah. Yes, and I skipped this little part, but it so relates to that, and I think is somewhat of a response to what does it mean? How do we fix our eyes on Jesus? He says, look is the most frequent command in the entire book of Revelation. The second most frequent is fear not. We obey the second by obeying the first. I thought that was really good. When we look, we are no longer afraid. Yes.
I also see it as the way you said he pulled back and saw the earth, and then he saw one man.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're going through hardships, it's hard because you see so many things, and everything's just muddled together, and it's overwhelming, and it's too much. So fixing your eyes on Jesus is narrowing your focus and just focus on the Word to get your to get your bearings again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how I would think that. That would be like step one.
Yeah.
Maybe
we need to do some zooming in.
Stopping all of this, you know, crazy bit and focusing on specific things.
That's good. You had something, yes.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting that you mentioned sort of things that were said in Isaiah, right? That Jesus repeats, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also going back to, like, fixing your eyes on Jesus, really interesting that Jesus also repeats, that prophecy that the Lord used to Isaiah, right, to give to the people of Israel. And when he sees the throne of God, when he says, you will indeed hear but never understand, right, and never indeed see but never perceive.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the question from that, right, is like, I feel like it's hard to have confidence, right, that you are sort of in this camp of like, oh, I'm like with the disciples, right, to whom Jesus says, blessed are your eyes, really see in your ears, really hear. For truly I say to you, many prophets and righteous people long to see what you see and did not see it, and to hear what you hear and did not hear it, right? And so
I
think there is still this like question of like longing, right? Where it's like, oh, like how do you have, I guess, confidence, right, that even with all your yearning, right, and your heart's desire, that you are actually able to see Jesus rightly, even from the text that is available today, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was curious if you had.
Specifically, how do we have confidence that what we see rightly?
Yeah, about like anything.
Yeah.
Right.
I guess I would say, again, a healthy amount of suspicion is in order. But, yeah, I guess something of, you're asking something along the lines of just kind of what is faith, too? What does it mean to be assured of what we haven't seen with our eyes? I think it's probably a blend of suspicion and trust. I don't know, do other people have thoughts, comments in response to that? Yeah? Dave?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the Christian life.
Yeah,
I guess,
exactly.
And yeah, I think it's, of course, you start with the suspicion and maybe you never give it up in this life because you see in part, but that the trust factor is, well, I trust Jesus wants me to see him and to grow in that, and there's not like a pinnacle in this age that I climb over and oh, now I've got Jesus fully in my vision and I see him exactly as he is. I mean, it says we will eventually see him as he is, and but in this age we see in part, and even even no matter how much sanctification we get in this life, I think that to see the growth in that, and to trust that Jesus will give us what's appropriate for us each day. So I always pray, what's good for today? Help me see and improve my vision for what's good and what I can handle and what I can live faithfully with this day or this season. I think it's totally connected with trust. That's what Jesus is after.
And to believe that he's not, you know, his desire, if we affirm the biblical witness, his desire isn't to trick us, but to actually give us clearer sight, not perfected sight, not God's sight, but that he's actually invited us into a relationship in which our eyes are being restored. The things that look like trees walking around are getting clearer. Ben?
There's a, it's not from the Bible, but it's from Screwtape Letters, people who've...
I almost said, that's pretty cool.
People who've spent at some point or other, I quote this at them. So there's this really encouraging moment where Screwtape is trying to advise this other demon how to trip up this person and lead him away from God, and tries to convince him, and in his prayer life, get him to imagine all kinds of false things about God, implying that somehow if you're praying to some misconception, you're not praying to the real God who's there.
Mm.
Of course, Screwtape doesn't understand the depth of God's mercy to us.
Yeah,
God just might accept prayers that were wrong-headed, right? He just might. Anyway, but he says... says something like, we're really in trouble. Whatever he says, we're really in trouble, that's obviously a good thing, you know, but we're really in trouble if the patient prays not to who I think you are, but to who thou knowest thyself to be. Basically, if you direct your prayer towards who you know you are, God.
Yeah. Wow.
Essentially, you know, rather than directing your prayers to who I know you are right now.
Yeah.
Which might be off.
Yeah.
And probably is for all of us to some degree.
Yeah.
But it's that stance of humility in prayer that says, you know, I know something true about you, otherwise I wouldn't be talking to you at all right now, but I probably don't have it all right.
Yeah.
So I want to be talking to the real you. So the real you, who's up there somewhere or with me right now, you're the one I want to hear this, you know, who you know yourself to be. That to me is really encouraging because it implies that we can, that God is merciful to us in our, maybe even in our bad theology as we pray.
Yeah.
Or, and obviously we can have such bad theology that maybe we really are quite far from speaking to the real God. But there's something about the posture of humility in prayer, because that's allowing God's sight to be the ultimate definer of this interaction, not who I know you are.
Like, there you go. Not like what I've constructed as who you are, but yeah, that's good. John?
Yeah, I'm just noticing you have the book Seeing God in your stack there, and I know you were excited about it. And
I didn't talk about it at all.
You didn't talk about it in the lecture, and I was just wondering if there was anything that you really wanted to say that maybe you didn't fit in. Because it seems interesting to me, too, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it became... So this is a book, it's called Seeing God, and it's about this kind of... the Christian history of believing the purpose of humanity is to see God face to face. That's our telos. That's our end. That's what we were made for. And in kind of Christian theology, that's been called the beatific vision. And that's the thing humans are made for, to see God. That used to be really popular, talked about, written about a ton in Christian circles, and then it's kind of hasn't been talked about a ton in the Protestant world recently. And I did read a lot of it, not all of it, in preparation for this, but it just got squeezed out, essentially, as something I couldn't quite add. I wanted to focus in on this idea of judging. Honestly, that's not what I thought I would find when I started working on this, and I just felt like that was the story that kept emerging. I kind of wanted it to be a different story. And I felt like over and over again, both God's sight and human sight is about this dividing, this judging, this wisdom, right? Knowing good from evil. And this is just a different topic. It's kind of the idea of when we die, we will do the thing we're made for. We will look on the face of God for all eternity, which is beautiful and could be a lecture all its own, but I don't have anything in particular I'm really itching to tell you about that book. It's like, you know, dealing with tons of different people in Christian history, how they thought about the beatific vision, what influenced them, what scriptures they leaned heavily on, why it hasn't been a popular topic in Christian theology recently. He's kind of trying to revive it and say, no, this is what we were made for. Like, we see in part, but we will see fully. We will see him face to face. He's dealing with those passages, but it just didn't quite fit into what I was doing. Yes?
This is more of a comment, not necessarily
a
question, but you were talking about how our vision is fragile.
Mm-hmm.
And at the college I went to, one of the theater's professors has retinitis pigmentosa.
Okay.
It's this, like, devastating disease where, like, you lose your sight slowly from the periphery.
Oh, goodness.
And he's a theater guy, and, like, a lot of his actions and thoughts and the way he performs on stage has to do with his sight.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave a lecture when I was there, and he titled it Visions and Revisions.
Hmm.
And he talked about how he's actually seeing things more clearly as he's going through this. And I'm thinking about that for a lot of other people, like, as we age, our eyesight starts to fail us.
Yeah.
But it's the wisdom that we've had when we've had that eyesight that kind of brings us to that end goal of seeing God. You know?
Yeah.
So it's interesting, like, how physical our eyes can be.
Yeah. Yep. I'm diabetic, so I'm also, like, hypersensitive to how my eyes are doing or not doing as I get older. But yeah, I think that takes me back to Saul's conversion in a way, too, that, to be struck blind when he meets Jesus. It's actually really different from what is said mostly about Jesus, that Jesus heals blindness, but that there's also this journey through naming, recognizing, owning, experiencing our own blindness. In or, I mean, he did physically, but also for all of us before we can kind of move into a restoration of sight. It sounds like, yeah, that professor could be experiencing something of that too. It's like when Saul was blinded, he saw most clearly.
Yeah.
Isn't that wild? Yeah.
I found what you said about Revelation really, really helpful. And it made me think of something Tim Keller talks about, prayer reorients our vision.
There you go.
And I'm just, and then thinking about John when he wrote Revelation. It's a time of intense persecution.
Yeah.
And you just imagine yourself in a situation where it seems, you know, Rome is this huge power and it's persecuting us and the Jews are persecuting us, and where is God?
Where is God?
And so
yeah.
That picture of repetition of looking at the throne,
yeah,
and reminding yourself that Jesus is on the throne.
Yeah.
Jesus is on the throne. That's actually a phrase in our we go to a black church and it's frequently mentioned. God is still on the throne.
Yeah.
I find that can be really helpful to me to reorient my
reorienting
when I listen to the news too much. Mm-hmm. And I think that really, it just seems like the world is out of control.
Yeah.
It seems like evil people are in control.
Yeah.
And so the prayer, the looking at the throne, the reminding myself and thinking of all the Christians throughout the ages. I've just been reading Jeremiah and thinking, what was Jeremiah thinking when he was in that pit?
Yeah.
And when he was in prison for a long time. Where is God?
Yeah.
You know, clinging to what we know is true, that he is on the throne.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing and what's happening now is temporary.
Yeah.
God is just that reorientation of vision is maybe what fixing our eyes on Jesus or
yeah.
Is
that's good.
That in terms of making us, giving us, again, faith to go on and to in real trust.
Yeah. I didn't say these words, but in many ways this felt like a lecture on the problem of evil.
Yeah.
I didn't use that phrase, but that's, you know, a persistent struggle in my own heart, in my own life. And yeah, it does get right down to what is faith?
Yeah.
Are we going to let our eyes tell us this is the whole story?
That's right.
This is all there is. Mm-hmm. I think the whole invitation is in the scriptures is to say no to that. To join John in a sort of peeling back and saying, no, the throne is occupied by the one who doesn't respond to everything in the timing that I would like him to. But again, what's been revealed is he doesn't do that because he's patient, not because he's abdicated, not because he's unaware, not because he's blind, not because he's deceitful, but because he's patient. Yes. Oh, yes. Please.
I haven't formed the question yet, but I'll try and
that's great.
Give you my notes and maybe you can figure it out. You mentioned the problem of evil, which every time I hear somebody say that, I think it's so diverse because there are multiple problems and they're all related to evil. But, for example, someone was just discussing how they've rejected the church as, for them, not going to work because of all of the evil in the church.
In the church, okay.
And we began discussing the diversity of the church and how, well, not every church is the same. You know, there's churches that look like this and churches that look like this.
Mm-hmm.
And because I noticed that some of her problems were with individual Christians. And I thought, well, I know a few Christians who don't hold those views and still follow Christ.
Yeah.
So I guess it came down to this, that there are multiple people with limited sight just foggy perception of who they're actually following.
Okay.
And something Ben said really clicked when he said it, and I won't try and quote him, but he helped me to see that, you know, all of us are foggy in our perception of who we're following. But God is a merciful God to allow us to pray to who we think he is. In actuality, there are several different theologies represented just in this room.
For sure.
And we all agree on a lot, I'm sure. But we don't go to the same church. And we would disagree if we spent more than 10 minutes discussing controversial topics with probably everyone in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I would say, I will follow Christ with those who follow Christ.
Yeah.
Regardless of political party or the views on important issues,
mm-hmm.
Which I would say divide churches. But my encouragement was to this person who had given up on the church, but not on Jesus.
Yeah.
You can follow Jesus with people you don't agree with.
Yeah.
Because we're all wrong about him, like Redmond.
There you go.
I guess implying.
And Jesus isn't ashamed to call us his brothers and sisters.
Yeah, exactly.
So we need to be really careful to say, I'm ashamed to call these people my brothers
right,
and
like
sisters.
Right. Well, I think it goes back to a lecture that Ben did a long time ago on, what was the title of it? What was what you wanted to call it? You wanted to call it. am I related to them? Yeah.
Oh, there we go.
And it was this whole idea.
It's about the family of God.
Yeah, it was really helpful. Because it was at the time when I guess I was just noticing how polarized inside of the church, not just the nation, but like.
Yeah, you're right.
In the church, we're polarized to the point where we almost are afraid to bring up how we voted with other Christians. Because it's obvious, you know, if they disagree with me, then they might stop talking to me.
Yeah. It's going to be a lecture on polarization next weekend. Joshua. That's my answer. nice to see you again, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah. Thought came to mind with this idea of humans being limited. So we talked about it in contrast to God being unlimited.
Yeah.
And it's kind of been alluded to, but it also opens up the idea of collectively we can have sight. And so this idea of like we all have foggy sight, but it's not the same foggy sight, right?
There you
so
go.
Different things, right? And different things wrong. And I feel like even the language perspective is kind of interesting here because it implies they're looking at the same thing from a different angle. So
I like that.
I feel like there's something in this interdependence that's actually really beautiful in us being limited.
Yeah.
Us having to rely on each other for a fuller sight.
Yeah, that's great. I didn't even think of that. That's beautiful that there can be a healing of our obscured vision, even just within the community of God. People helping us to see what we don't see. Yes, maybe just two more comments. Sarah, you want to go first? You haven't said anything.
The passage that your lecture made me think of, and that as I have known you've been working on this, I've been thinking about, is where Jesus, this is in John 9, going into John 10.
Oh, yeah, John 9.
Where
big
he
one.
Heals the man who was born blind. Mm-hmm. He's got this, like, unfolding conflict with Pharisees. And then at the end of John 9, Jesus says, for judgment, I came into this world that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things. So he says this to the man that he healed. And then some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, are we also blind? And Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, we see, your guilt remains. And then, like, what I think is so amazing is, like, from there, we have this chapter break, but take the chapter break out, it's like Jesus just keeps talking, and this is where he says, truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs in by another way, that man is the thief and the robber. And he goes into, I'm the door of the sheep, I am the good shepherd, the sheep hear my voice, know me. And so like this connection again between sight and hearing.
Yeah.
And what strikes me as I think about it now is like there's just a beautiful double-edged prayer for us, you know, to pray that, you know, we would be healed of our blindness and pray that we'd be blinded in the areas that we think we see. I see. make me blind, Lord, so that I might hear your voice and follow you. And remember that I'm a sheep, I think, which is a collective identity. One of the sheep. anyway.
Thank you.
Passage.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Mary Frances?
This is just a quick comment to what Brandon did. I think that this idea of like the communality of sight, and I think I've said many times before, I think one of the functions of relationship in a community is for people to act as a mirror to us, to help us see things that we can't see about ourselves. And I have had a couple of seasons in my life where I have specifically said to those close to me, I need your vision here because I don't feel like I can see.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see the way forward, or I don't feel like I can see myself.
Yeah.
I'm not seeing myself well, but we don't always have that awareness. But there have been times in my life where I've been very much caught up short by my own ability to see, and I have invited others to speak into that place for me, and it's been really significant and beautiful, and God in a couple different places has used those friends and those people and their words. Really, many of us have been seeds that then later down the road actually came to fruition in ways I wouldn't have expected, and so I just want to kind of
share that.
I think that's really important.
Yeah.
That,
Part of the recognizing we're limited is to invite others to help us in our limitations. That's really good. Well, I think we could wrap this up. I just wanted to maybe end by reading you a couple interactions when Jesus heals the blind, the various blind people. And this just be what I leave you with. A bit of their back and forth, two of their back and forth, both from Matthew. And receive this even as into your own life. Have mercy on us, son of David. And Jesus said, do you believe that I am able to do this? Yes, Lord, they replied. Have mercy on us. Jesus asked, what do you want me to do for you? Lord, we want our sight. Thank you all for your questions and comments.